It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, August 4. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. A reminder, starting Thursday, this podcast is changing. You will now be able to get the latest hourly newscast from NPR News in this podcast. And if you want all of the news from our reporters and hosts, subscribe to our new podcast. It's called The Ticker. You can find it on iTunes and at nprnews.org/podcasts. Now today's news. At least 342 people who say they were sexually abused by priests have filed claims against the Twin Cities Archdiocese, Madeline Barron reports.
Monday was the deadline for creditors to file claims against the Archdiocese in bankruptcy. Victims attorney Mike Finnegan says that by the end of the day, the firm had filed 342 claims on behalf of victims of clergy sex abuse. He expects a few dozen more claims could have been filed by other attorneys or by victims without an attorney. The final number is not yet available in court records. About 300 additional non-abuse claims were also filed, most of them on behalf of parishes and schools. Now that the claims deadline has passed, the Archdiocese, insurers, and creditors committees will evaluate the claims and try to agree on a plan to pay them. That process could take months or even years. Madeline Barron, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has drafted a plan to cut the amount of road salt in Twin Cities streams and lakes. Here's Matt Sepik.
An MPCA study found 37 bodies of water that have excessive levels of chloride. Too much salt can harm fish and encourage invasive plants. The MPCA's Brian Livingston says cutting back on road salt won't mean slicker winter driving.
We're finding ways to apply salt in the winter, less amounts, but being still as effective and not jeopardizing public safety.
For example, Livingston says wetting the salt before applying it helps the crystals stick to the pavement and reduces the amount of salt needed. The agency is taking public comment on the plan through September 2nd. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Governor Mark Dayton has appointed former House DFL Majority Leader Tony Sertich to serve on the board overseeing the construction of the billion-dollar Viking Stadium. Tim Pugmire has more.
Sertich will fill a vacancy on the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority created by the recent resignation of Dwayne Benson, who quit after a public feud with the board chair. Sertich is currently president of the Northland Foundation and previously served as Dayton's commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board. Dayton praised Sertich for his experience with major economic development projects and his ability to bring together fractious leaders. The legislature established the five-member MSFA in 2012. The governor appoints three members, including the chair. U.S. Bank Stadium is scheduled for completion in 2016. Tim Pugmire, Minnesota Public Radio News at the Capitol.
Republican lawmakers say any special session to help businesses around Lake Mille Lacs needs to include changes to the Department of Natural Resources. They say the DNR is partially responsible for mismanaging the walleye population in the lake. Tom Shack has more.
Republican House Speaker Kurt Dowd says a working group looking to help the resort owners on Lake Mille Lacs will hold its first meeting today. He said the group will look at short-term options to help businesses on the lake, but he also wants long-term solutions. One thing he wants to look at is the Department of Natural Resources.
The DNR does need to be included in special session discussion, and specifically, how they've managed the population of walleyes in the lake and whether there are things that could be done differently.
The criticism of the DNR comes as the department took the unprecedented step of ending the walleye fishing season early on the lake because the annual harvest supply has been exhausted. Resort owners, anglers, and others have criticized the decision. Many say they think the DNR's analysis is wrong. Karen McCoyd, owner of Max Twin Bay Resort in Isle, will serve on the working group. She said last week she lacks confidence in the DNR's science.
We're raising the concerns because we don't think it's being managed properly. We don't think that they're making appropriate estimates of the numbers of fish on the lake, and that is causing economic disaster in our area.
Governor Dayton says he's willing to call a special session to help McCoyd and other resort owners. He suggested zero-interest loans for resort owners and increased marketing of the strong bass, northern pike, and muskie fishing on Mille Lacs. But Republican Senator Carrie Rood of Breezy Point said she wants a broader discussion that focuses on the DNR. Rood wants greater oversight of Native American fishing practices and stronger action taken to limit invasive species and predatory birds.
You have to address the netting. You have to address the zebra mussels. You have to address the cormorants. You have to address the management practices that have gone on that lake. And unless you address the problems, just throwing cash at it doesn't really get us anywhere.
The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe said last week it will suspend its gill netting in 2016. And Governor Dayton has acknowledged the criticism of the DNR, suggesting the department needs a lesson in customer service. He also suggested making changes to personnel overseeing fishing on Lake Mille Lacs. Dayton, however, expressed full confidence in DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr. Landwehr, who will serve on the working group, said he's willing to listen to lawmakers' concerns about his agency, but he said the DNR is basing its decisions on sound science. He said many of the problems on the lake don't have simple solutions.
A lake is not like a video game where you can just turn a button here and the volume goes up or turn a button there and the color changes. A lake is much more dynamic, and so it's, well, accountability is a great thing, and I believe in it. It's not as easy as, you know, managing to make my car run. It is something much more complex.
Landwehr said anglers have to acknowledge that Lake Mille Lacs is changing, and the changes include a much clearer lake, more predator fish, and a decline in male walleyes. DFL Senate Majority Leader Tom Bach says those criticizing the DNR need to look in the mirror. Bach said many have been reluctant to accept the DNR's past attempts to protect the walleye population.
The public's been real slow at coming along supporting the changes, like, you know, the closing of night fishing and the reduced limits. There's been a lot of pushback that the DNR has gotten from the public. So there's some blame to go around with the public, too, being unwilling to accept the fact that that the fishery's not stable right now.
Landwehr says he's hopeful that the walleye population in the lake can be restored. In the meantime, the governor said he's heading to Mille Lacs on Saturday to showcase the other fishing options the lake has to offer. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Those other fishing options include bass, muskie, and northern pike. Tony Roach has been a fishing guide on Mille Lacs and other lakes in the area for 20 years, and he joined Kathy Werzer on the phone.
Do you have clients you're going to take out today?
I do, yeah.
Where are you going to go?
We're going to go today. We're actually going to be around the Aiken area, which is just north of Mille Lacs Lake. I spent a lot of time this past week around Brainerd as well. We do a lot of trips around Brainerd just because it's such a tourist destination.
How will the closing of the walleye season on Mille Lacs affect your business?
Well, I'm not worried about this season. You know, we're pretty locked in with our clients. We called our other clients when we heard the news. It's the tourism and the out-of-state tourism that you get for next season. Everything trickles down. You know, if the bite's good one season, the next year business is up. If we have a troubling situation like we have now, next year, that's what I worry about. People coming from out of state that have heard the news about Mille Lacs Lake to say, oh boy, we're not going to book our vacation there next year.
Now, you've been a guide for a long time. Have you noticed a change in the last few years in the fish you were catching out of Mille Lacs?
Yeah, you know, more so a year or two ago. You know, we're really on the rebound right now, and I think that is the sole reason the DNR wants to protect these year classes coming up is we have some incredible year classes and incredible recruitment in the populations of the 2012, 2013, and 2014 year classes. So there's an overwhelming amount of 6 to, let's say, 14-inch walleyes in the lake right now. They're really vulnerable to hooking mortality and anglers catching them. They're catching them at a very rapid rate, and that's what they're trying to protect with the warmer water in August.
Do you think there needs to be more education, perhaps, when it comes to anglers as to how to fish, perhaps, to help this particular lake?
Yeah, I mean, definitely fish handling is something that, you know, I talk about quite often with anglers. And you know, in the past, I've seen some things among anglers that I was really unsatisfied about, maybe not anglers in my boat, but just anglers out there. You know, for years with slot limits, there's lots and lots of big walleyes in Mille Lacs Lake. I mean, that's always been the case and has been really, really really been the case over for the past decade. Well, you know, those anglers aren't able to keep those fish. So a lot of times you see them remove the hook and just kind of toss that fish out into the water. Well, that can do some real damage to the fish. That's a fish that spawns millions of eggs every year, every spring. And that's something that we really need to keep in the lake. And it's something that you, walleyes of that size just aren't everywhere. I mean, Minnesota is definitely a walleye destination for a lot of folks across the country. However, there's only a few fisheries that have those great big walleyes like Mille Lacs Lake. And we need to really treat those fish with care. And really what I mean by that is just unhooking them, gently tossing them in the water, not letting them bounce around in the deck of your boat, taking a bunch of photos. That's really how you minimize any sort of hooking mortality.
Now, as you know, the governor is going to go fish Mille Lacs on Saturday for bass, smallmouth bass, and in northern pike, if he's lucky. Do you think many anglers who wanted to go after walleye Mille Lacs will be interested in pursuing other species?
You know, that's a tough question because you have a lot of anglers out there that are super passionate about bass fishing. Obviously, northern pike, Mille Lacs is a great destination for northern pike. You know, to say that the anglers that were interested in walleye fishing are going to go bass fishing, I don't know if that'll take place. However, there's a couple good things that are happening right now. Mille Lacs is one of the top 10 destinations for smallmouth bass in the country. However, I go to a lot of national fishing conventions. I work with other anglers across the country. Some of them are tournament bass anglers, and a lot of them have never heard of Mille Lacs Lake. So our goal as Minnesotans is we should really try to get the word out among people in the U.S. that we have this great smallmouth fishery, because as soon as the walleyes bounce back, now not only are you going to get the walleye anglers coming back to Mille Lacs Lake, but you're going to have bass anglers from all over the country staying in the area.
Say, final question here. There are a lot of people listening, Tony, who are not anglers, who are probably scratching their heads over all the attention being given to the walleye. Now, it is the state fish, obviously, but why? What's the allure of walleye fishing?
You know, walleyes are a challenging fish to catch. You know, at times it seems like they're jumping in the boat, and other times they're within the hour, really. They can turn off and be quite finicky. You know, you hear that a lot, finicky walleyes. That's kind of the allure for me. They were always the challenging fish to catch growing up. You know, it started out in Minnesota, obviously. Walleye is known for its table fare. It's excellent eating fish. And so, you know, that's kind of how it started out. However, as sport angling continues to grow and sport fishing for walleyes continue to grow, it's not just about the table fare. It's about the challenge of the fish itself.
Tony, thank you for your time this morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
That's Kathy Werzer and Tony Roach on Morning Edition. Minnesota is getting a refund of sorts after widespread problems at testing company Pearson delayed Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments, or MCAs, this spring. To make up for the test glitches, the state's contract with Pearson will be reduced by $1 million, and the company will provide millions of dollars in additional services at no cost. Pearson also said it is taking steps to prevent testing problems in the future. Tim Post reports.
This spring, thousands of Minnesota students had a tough time logging into their online MCAs, the tests that measure proficiency in reading, math, and science. The delays frustrated students, teachers, and test coordinators whose school schedules were disrupted by the problems. The State Department of Education halted testing on two separate days because of the glitches. Testing company Pearson determined hackers were overwhelming the company's servers with so-called denial-of-service attacks. In recent weeks, the department has been negotiating with the company over how to make amends for the delays. Spokesperson Josh Collins says the department feels good about the settlement the two sides agreed to.
I think what we've arrived at here is a settlement that is appropriate. It's sizable. And I believe it recognizes and acknowledges how significant those disruptions were.
Pearson will knock $1 million off the $40.8 million bill for the three-year contract it has with the state. Pearson will also provide several additional services at no cost to Minnesota school districts that it values at nearly $4.7 million. That includes paying districts to cover the cost of giving some students the ACT college entrance exam. After 1 year of the state paying for every student to take the test, lawmakers dropped that program during their special session. In return, they're giving the Department of Education $3 million a year to reimburse districts for administering the ACT to their students. The department is worried that won't be enough, so Pearson has agreed to pick up the difference, whatever that amount might be. Collins says the agreement with Pearson also includes assurances that similar problems won't happen again.
To make sure that we're addressing things moving forward so that we don't have a repeat of these types of disruptions.
Pearson says it will move the MCAs to a more secure cloud-based testing system. Company officials say that system was unaffected by hacking attacks this spring. Laura Howe is a spokesperson for Pearson.
We regret that the testing was disrupted in the first place, but you know, we're really pleased to be able to move to a different platform.
Howe says Pearson is pleased the problems didn't appear to affect Minnesota students' assessment test scores. Last week, the Education Department released an independent report that found no overall effect on student scores despite the widespread delays. The head of the statewide teachers' union, Education Minnesota, questions that report, saying she doesn't trust this year's MCA scores. In a statement, Denise Specht said she's glad Pearson took responsibility for the testing problems, but doesn't think the settlement was big enough, considering the frustration and anxiety that teachers and students faced. Tim Post, Minnesota Public Radio News.
President Obama has a plan to cut carbon emissions from power plants, but what does that mean for Minnesota? The short answer, it's complicated. Each state has a different target, and for Minnesota, it's about a 40% cut in carbon pollution by the year 2030. The question remains how much Minnesota's progress to this point has helped. Elizabeth Dunbar reports.
In a way, the state of Minnesota was prepared for this moment. It's been more than a year since the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released its proposed clean power plan with targets for each state, and some here in Minnesota balked. That's because states like North Dakota had really low targets, while Minnesota and other states that have already been working to clean up their energy sources were stuck with bigger reductions. David Thornton is an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. He says it will take weeks for his staff to analyze Minnesota's obligations under the revised rule the EPA released yesterday. But so far, he says he's encouraged.
We think this final plan is a more balanced and fair plan, and it does a better job of recognizing the kind of work that we've already done here in Minnesota.
So even if Minnesota's target is as high as 40%, Thornton says when it comes to the things the state's utilities will need to do to meet it, the efforts could be minimal.
I think it will require more, but we're not sure how much at this point. We're currently on target to be very close.
That's because in recent years, Minnesota's utilities have had to change the way they generate electricity because of state laws. One says large utilities must produce a quarter of electricity from renewable sources by 2025. A more recent law mandates that utilities add solar to their energy mix. You'll hear coal-dependent utilities in other parts of the country complain about possible energy price hikes and threaten lawsuits against the EPA. But not so far in Minnesota. The two utilities that will play the biggest role in Minnesota's carbon reduction plan say they're on their way to meeting the targets. Xcel Energy's CEO even participated at the White House ceremony announcing the EPA's rule. Minnesota Power spokeswoman Amy Rutledge says the Northern Minnesota utility's goal is a mix of one-third renewable energy, one-third coal, and one-third natural gas.
We think that that strategy has Minnesota Power well positioned to meet the Clean Power Plan, as well as Minnesota's own greenhouse gas reduction goal as well.
Details about how both Xcel and Minnesota Power will meet the new rule are expected as part of each utility's resource plan filed with state regulators. Xcel's is already underway, and Minnesota Power will submit its plan September 1st. Environmental groups like the Sierra Club will continue the push to retire coal-fired power plants, including Xcel's two older coal units at the Sherburne County Generating Station. Xcel has not committed to doing that, but Minnesota Power recently announced plans to stop burning coal at a smaller plant, Taconite Harbor in Schroeder, next year. The next steps could include a combination of energy efficiency, switching some coal plants to natural gas, and increasing wind and solar energy. Fresh Energy's J. Drake Hamilton, who was at the White House for the carbon reduction rollout, says it won't be hard for Minnesota to get there.
We know how to do this. We know how to do it cost effectively. And in Minnesota, we've done it through utility collaboration and really smart energy policies to save energy and grow clean energy jobs.
But some state lawmakers say Minnesota still isn't getting enough credit for taking early action. Republican Representative Pat Garofalo of Farmington oversees the House Energy Committee.
From Minnesota's perspective, this is really the worst of both worlds. Over the last 10 years, we've already spent the money to reduce our emissions significantly, and now the federal government is failing to give us credit for the money we've already invested to do this.
Garofalo says whatever plan the state comes up with will need lots of scrutiny, and he plans to push again next year to require the agencies drafting the plan to seek legislative approval. Meanwhile, those charged with figuring out Minnesota's energy future have a lot of reading to do. The EPA carbon rule is over 1,500 pages long. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The man accused of killing his 10-year-old son and throwing his body in the Mississippi River this spring was sentenced yesterday to 40 years in prison. Tim Nelson was in the courtroom, and he joined Steve and John last night.
Authorities said they had a strong circumstantial case against Pierre Collins after they found his son's body in April. Did Pierre Collins explain what happened?
Well, he told Hennepin County Judge Tanya Bransford that he had killed his son. He said he saw Barway outside their apartment when the boy got home from school on March 18th. Pierre Collins said he was angry about something. He said he hit Barway and that the boy fell. He said that he then took Barway to the river, duct taped his arms and legs, and threw him in the water. Now, no witnesses have come forward to confirm that sequence of events. Barway's body was found in the river near Brooklyn Center almost a month after he disappeared by a group of Boy Scouts that had joined the search for him.
Why did Pierre Collins plead guilty now? This comes as kind of a surprise. He's been in jail for, what, more than 3 months, had a trial date set for next year?
Well, he was indicted on first-degree murder charges in June. As you recall, authorities found he stood to benefit from a life insurance policy on his son and that he tried to increase the death benefit just 2 days before Barway died. Collins also visited what authorities believe was the scene of the crime earlier that day. That intent and planning could have made him subject to the mandatory life without parole sentence if he'd been convicted of first-degree murder. This guilty plea may allow him to spend at least some of his life outside of prison. The statutory maximum for second-degree murder is 40 years, and with good behavior, he could be out in a little less than 30.
What was the reaction to the plea at the courthouse?
Well, we heard from a man who said he was speaking for the Liberian community. Collins and his son were both Liberian immigrants, and this came on the heels of the Ebola epidemic that killed thousands of people in that country. Sam Yamala talked about the shock that this added to Minnesota's Liberian community. Barway's stepmother, Jennifer Beaver, also talked about how difficult this was for her own children to finally find out that their father had killed their stepbrother.
Barway Collins' birth mother traveled from Liberia, where the child was born, for his funeral and for the upcoming trial. And I assume she has stuck around. Was she in court?
She was. Her sobbing interrupted the hearing at one point. Pierre Collins didn't go into a lot of detail, but the truth of what actually happened to Barway was clearly very, very hard on his mother and family. And they remained very suspicious about this case. You may recall that the last anyone seems to have seen of Barway was a little clip of videotape from the school van that dropped him off that day. Barway was heard saying he saw his uncle. Now, Barway's family questions why he said that. They say they don't think Pierre Collins has come completely clean about the murder of his son. A member of Barway's family, Emmanuel Monluo, spoke after the sentencing.
We feel that there's some issue behind this confession. Pierre has not been fair to us from the onset. Pierre has not been trustworthy. And we expected more from him today. But at least for now, we can tell that justice has been done.
That said, Crystal Police Chief Stephanie Revering said today that they do believe Pierre Collins acted alone, and they're satisfied now that this case is closed.
All right. Thank you very much, Tim.
You're welcome.
Tim Nelson, Steve and John on All Things Considered. Time now for more Minnesota Sounds and Voices. Here's Steve and John with the intro.
Most of us don't take time to look, but to foragers, the outdoors, even in the Twin Cities, is like a vast grocery store.
We're just going to kind of walk the woods and see what we can find. We hopefully will find something that's really yummy.
In a new edition of Minnesota Sounds and Voices, reporter Dan Olson joins a forager in search of food.
Within minutes of the start of our search, Maggie Taylor hits pay dirt.
When you see an oak tree, kind of look around and say, oh.
We're on public land in a northern Twin Cities suburb, and forager Maggie Taylor is grinning from ear to ear at a gorgeous little collection of mushrooms.
Nice, beautiful, egg yolk, yellow, center of.
Twig in hand, Taylor carefully lifts fallen oak leaves aside, and voila!
Oh, look at these. Now here's a whole family.
The usually unflappable Taylor is joyous. Through decades of foraging, she's never run into this kind of chanterelle mushroom motherlode.
Oh my gosh, I'm speechless.
It's not like it's a truckload. The chanterelles probably number two dozen or so, enough to fill the bottom of Taylor's tote bag. But it's a forager's dream come true and a bit of an economic bounty. You could easily spend a lot of money on chanterelles at the grocery store.
They're a choice edible mushroom. And you usually could find them at co-ops when it's in season for about $25 a pound.
Maggie Taylor forages at a measured pace. She doesn't want to go too fast and miss something. Even so, it's like a session at the gym, because she's always bending over or in movement of some kind as her search intensifies.
You know, I don't like to exercise, but once I get this mushrooming in my blood, there's no stopping me until I drop dead.
Margaret Kwong Taylor, who goes by Maggie, was born in China. Taylor says her foraging started in childhood out of boredom since the kids had no toys.
We'd go pick leaves and we would boil it and make a sap. Whatever smelled really bad, it's got to be good.
The Kwong family arrived in Columbia Heights when Maggie was 13. She and her four brothers and sisters concentrated on learning English. Everyone worked at the family restaurant, the Dragon House in Columbia Heights, started by her father and mother in 1972. Taylor says depending on the season, foragers find a wide range of edibles.
Raspberries, you can always find garlic mustard. It makes a very good pesto. The plantain, you can actually pick them and make a tea.
Taylor is an avid but cautious forager. She estimates she can safely identify 30 mushrooms, edible and otherwise, and observes a strict rule.
When in doubt, throw it out.
Taylor says many foragers are secretive. They don't tell anyone about their favorite locations. Other than getting lost, Taylor says she's directionally challenged. Foraging doesn't pose many safety issues, with two exceptions.
Every year I have gotten poison ivy, and I have gotten ticks too.
In the Dragon House restaurant kitchen, Taylor gently but thoroughly washes the chanterelle mushrooms to remove the sand. Then she pulls them apart like string cheese, pops them onto a grill, and fries them in a couple of teaspoons of coconut oil. Taylor gently lays the mushrooms in three scrambled eggs, along with onions, tomato, and green pepper, and presents the finished product, an omelet. Maggie Taylor says part of the joy of foraging is in the eating, and the rest is being outdoors, savoring nature.
Listening to the birds and just feel the breeze. It's everything.
That's forager Maggie Taylor. By the way, she's careful to note that foraging is not allowed on all public land, so be sure to check first. Dan Olson is our Minnesota Sounds and Voices reporter. I'm Phil Picardi with the NPR News Update. I'll be back with the Wednesday News.